Awesome. Yeah, that's so true. We'll never really be able to comprehend what Jesus did for us fully. It's just incredible to be loved that much. That's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. So we're going to be in 1 Samuel 27 this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 27. I want to read verses 1 through 4 to start off. Verse 1 says, "Then David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand.' So David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And then it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him." So some of y'all may have noticed that we skipped chapter 26. Just jumped right over it. Well, the reason for that is because 26 is a lot like 24. In chapter 24, Saul is actively hunting David. And when Saul unknowingly wanders close to where David is, David creeps up on him undetected. Remember in the cave? And, David could have killed him. He was actually encouraged to kill him, but he doesn't. And he won't. Because Saul is God's anointed king, and David will not raise his hand against God's anointed. This was a defining moment for David, because the outcome of that encounter was entirely up to David, and he chose to show mercy over taking vengeance. Well, chapter 26 is that same kind of story. King Saul is with his army commander Abner, who's also his cousin. Remember, Saul's got trust issues, so he surrounds himself with kinfolk whenever he can. And these two guys are asleep. They're bedded down for the night, and they're sleeping in the middle of the camp with their soldiers spread out all around them. It's a security move. The thought is, if you want Saul, you got to make it past the rest of the army. Well, David does that. He and his friend Abishai sneak down to where Saul and Abner are sleeping, and they take Saul's spear and a jug of water that's sitting by Saul's head. Then they cross the valley back toward the hills, and they stand on top of a ridge, putting plenty of distance between them and the army. And then David calls out to Saul and to Abner, just like he did in chapter 24 in those caves at En-Gedi. And that same type of back and forth between David and Saul occurs. David tries reasoning with him. He's like, "Look, I've got your spear and your Yeti bottle. I'm not trying to kill you. I'm not your enemy. Please stop this." And of course, Saul gets all emotional once again. He starts sucking snot, telling David how righteous he is and how much he loves him and how he will never do anything like this ever again. But David says something to Saul in chapter 26 that sort of forecasts what is going to happen in chapter 27. It's easy to miss, and it's in verse 19. I want to read that verse. It says, "Now therefore let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day, that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, 'Go, serve other gods.'" And in chapter 27, David leaves the lands of Israel, and he goes to live in the lands of the Philistines. He ends up staying there for about a year and a half. So why is that important? Well, there's a term in academic circles called cosmic geography, okay? And what it means is that in the ancient world, these different cultures, they viewed their gods as being directly tied to their lands. This is where we get phrases like God of the mountains, God of the valley, God of the sea, God of the deserts, where all that comes from. Well, all the nations around Israel had their own gods who they served, right? A lot of them served multiple gods. Some had these divine hierarchies where you had like a chief god who was, you know, like the supreme god. And he had lesser gods under him. Egypt and Greece are like those. But Israel was unique in that they had only one God, Yahweh. And their one God gave them these lands. He brought them out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Remember, that phrase is repeated over and over throughout the earliest Old Testament writings. And Yahweh does that so he can give them these lands, this land flowing with milk and honey. It's a land that he first brought Abraham to give to Abraham and to his descendants. God does that in Genesis 12. After the Tower of Babel incident in Genesis 11, where God confuses language and scatters all these humans to different areas to set up different cultures. Because Yahweh, the God of the universe, was starting over with Abraham. He was divorcing those people and devoting himself to this one man and his family. And they would be the ones that God would build his chosen nation through. Well, a huge part of that nation building is the land. Because to have a nation, you need three things. You need a common language, you need a shared culture, and you need defined borders. Israel can never truly be Israel apart from the land. It's why dozens of wars have been fought over this little chunk of dirt the size of New Jersey for thousands of years. Because the land matters. It matters because it's tied to the worship of your God. I'll give you an example. In 2 Kings 5, there's a story about Naaman. He was commander of Syria's army and he had leprosy, nasty disease. He was told about Elisha, the great prophet in Israel, and how he could heal Naaman of his leprosy. So Naaman goes to see Elisha, and Elisha heals him completely. And after he's healed, this is what Naaman says to Elisha. This is verse 15 of 2 Kings 5. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him. And he said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant." But he said, "As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Then Naaman said, "If not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth. For from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but the Lord." Naaman didn't believe he could worship Yahweh if he wasn't standing on Yahweh's dirt. It's all connected in the ancient world. Now, after all that, let's go back to 1 Samuel 27, verse 1. Then David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines." You see what's happening now, don't you? You see why this is so important. Why this matters so much. If we were keeping score, this is the lowest point in David's life. I mean, he has to look up to see rock bottom. That's how low he is. It is extremely sad that David has decided that Yahweh either can't or won't protect him from Saul, despite all the evidence to the contrary. He's convinced himself that it will be better for him to live among a different people who serve a different God than to stay in this land and serve this God. Y'all, David is utterly hopeless. He's lost his faith. He's lost his trust. He's lost his identity. He doesn't know who or what he is at the moment. He's in a very dark place. And you know, the writer tells us that David said all these things in his heart. So he didn't say them out loud. He didn't share his heart with one of his companions who'd surely proven themselves trustworthy by now, right? I mean, they've been through a lot together. They've proven themselves to David. But David doesn't even share what's in his heart with his God, even though his God already knows everything that's in David's heart. And David knows that. He's in a very desperate place. And I know we like to say that, you know, God is unchanging, right? That he's the same now as he was then. And all that's true. But our great enemy is pretty consistent too. These are our enemy's tactics. These are the same tactics he uses on us. He hasn't been able to kill David, though he's tried. He hasn't gotten David to violate his conscience yet. He was about to with Nabal, but God sent Abigail to swoop in and talk David down, remember? That's chapter 25. The enemy hasn't even been able to really damage David's reputation. He's still somewhat larger than life in a lot of people's eyes. So since he can't stop David from being David, I guess the next best thing is to let David be David somewhere else. Not in this land. Not to the benefit of these people. Not in service to this God. And it worked. Y'all, this is why community is so important. There's my nail. I'm going to keep hammering. And it's not just being part of a community. It's engaging with that community. What our enemy did is isolated David. He tries the same thing with us. David had a community of over 1,000 people. These are folks who loved him and were loyal to him. They all wanted good for David. They would have sacrificed and given whatever they could to help David, but he withdrew from them. He stopped letting them in. And we all know you don't have to be alone to feel really lonely. That's where David is right now. Because this roller coaster life he's been on, these ups and downs, these highs and lows, it's really wearing him down. The first 20-ish years of his life were quiet and predictable. The last five or so have been anything but. And David doesn't know how to manage this. He needs help, but he won't ask for help. Because he's a guy. And that's what we do. And notice the timing of it, y'all. David had just humbled Saul again. He knows Yahweh put Saul right in his hand to do good or to do harm. The choice was David's. And David handled it perfectly again. He was riding so high. Now look at him. Isn't this how it works? You have those incredible victories in life, and then the enemy comes and just takes your legs right out from under you. He doubts God's favor. He doubts God's promises. He no longer believes that God will do what he said he would do. Now, there's no record of David ever worshiping the gods of the Philistines. But by leaving Israel and moving his life to Gath, that's exactly the road he set himself on. And his wives. And his children. It wasn't just himself. There were hundreds of people he took with him. Families who were loyal to him, who looked to him for leadership. His wives, his family. Even Abigail. This is the same Abigail who David referred to as a gift from the Lord. And now he's taking her away from her heritage to live among these ungodly, hateful people. And you know, again, David tried this Gath experiment before. Y'all remember back in chapter 21? That didn't go well at all. If it wasn't for God's favor, David never would have made it out of there alive. And now he's going back. Makes me think of all those times I pleaded with God to just get me out of this situation. Or God, just make all this stop. And I promise I will never do this again. And 3 days later, I'm back doing the exact same thing that got me in trouble in the first place. I heard a guy refer to that time in his life as his 20s. But I will say, for David, this time is different because David's not alone this time. He's got 600 trained warriors with him. And you know Achish, the king of Gath, he sees that and he thinks, oh yeah, I can use this. I've got my very own death squad, personally trained by the great giant killer himself. Y'all come on in and sit down. Let's talk. Plus, by now, Achish has to know about this conflict between David and Saul. So it's like that old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And Achish treats David like a friend. He really does. David asks him for a place outside the city, just some land on the outskirts where David and his companions can live by themselves. And Achish gave him a whole city. He gave him a fortified city named Ziklag. And y'all, that conversation between David and Achish is heartbreaking. Look at verses 5 through 7. It says, then David said to Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the rural city with you? So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. So David sets up this request with, if I have found favor in your eyes. Since when does David care if an enemy of Israel likes him or not? And what's worse is he refers to himself as Achish's servant at the end of verse 5. This is really not good. David is in such a bad place, and it's just moving from bad to worse. And y'all, this is David. His name means beloved. He's the man after God's own heart. He's chosen by God to lead his people. And now, he's just a hired gun. That's all he is. He's a mercenary. He's Achish's personal desperado. Look at verse 8. Look at this. Now David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the garments, and come back to Achish. So if you notice the names of the folks David's attacking, these are enemies of Israel, okay? Generational enemies of Israel. And David kills everybody. Everybody. The word raid in verse 8 comes from a word meaning to strip, which carries the idea of stripping the dead for anything valuable. David's a Viking now, basically. Just raiding and pillaging and killing. And in the verses that follow, we see why he does this. Look at verse 10. It says, when Achish asked, where have you made a raid today? David would say, against the Negeb of Judah, or against the Negeb of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negeb of the Kenites. And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking lest they should tell about us and say, so David has done. Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. So David and his assault team would raid and pillage Israel's enemies. Okay? Then when Achish asked him where all he went, he'd lie to him. And he'd say that he made raids in Israel and in the territories of people friendly to Israel. And just to cover his tracks, he made sure everybody in those towns were dead before he left. So nobody could make it back to Gath and tell them what really happened and where David really went. David's gone. This is horrible. Not because David was ashamed of what he did, but he wanted Achish to think that David was so far removed from his country that he was willing to attack his own people. So for Achish, this is working out better than he ever dreamed, right? Look at verse 12. It says, and Achish trusted David, thinking he has made himself an utter stench to his people Israel. Therefore, he shall always be my servant. You know, if we were to rank David's most egregious sins, and they're piling up, what happened with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah, that's the famous one. That's the one people really know about. That may be number one, but this is a very close second. That may even be 1 and 1A. I don't know. But I think you can make the argument that what David's done here in chapter 27 indirectly leads to what happens with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. Let me explain that. I'll explain it with a couple verses. James 1, verses 13 and 15 say this. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. The roots of what David does to Uriah, who was one of his mighty men, by the way. He may even be here with David in chapter 27. I don't know. It wasn't just some stranger. He was a close companion of David's. What David does to Uriah, the roots of that begin right here in chapter 27. What David does to his loyal friend to cover up his sin, that evil has its roots here. Because you have David killing innocent people, villages full of innocent people, just so he can cover up his sin. And I think I got problems. That's bad. Y'all, if there is a frequent, habitual sin in your life, I mean that chronic sin that keeps showing back up, that you've been covering up, you need to pull it out by its roots. We really do. Because if we don't and it continues to grow, the consequences could be disastrous. Look at David. I really think that's what happened to David. Years and decades of covering and hiding and deflecting. And the collateral damage to David in his later years was catastrophic. Because when sin is fully grown, it brings forth death. And too often, we try to manage our sin with like a lawnmower, you know? We ride over it, we cut it real short, real even, making sure it kind of blends in with everything else around it. And we think as long as we can keep that mowed, we can keep it down, nobody's ever going to know about it. Because I sure ain't going to tell them, right? I like my sin being hidden. It stays my sin at that point. But instead, we should grab that sin and we should rip it out by the roots. We should dig it up with a shovel if that's what we need to do. But we don't want to do that because that leaves holes in the yard. People notice holes in the yard. People walk by your house and be like, hey man, what's going on over there? Everything okay? We don't like that. I don't like that. Folks start asking questions. They start paying more attention. They start noticing those inconsistencies in my life. I don't want folks in my business. David didn't either. So, like David, like he did in verse 1, we say in our hearts things that help us justify keeping that sin hidden, keeping it pushed down. Until the day comes, according to James, and it will, when we can't hide our sin anymore. We can't. It's grown too much. It's grown too much. I remember when Lori was pregnant with Victoria. Lori was a little bitty old thing when she got pregnant. So it seemed like she started showing after about, 4 days? I mean, it was funny. She was this little bitty body with this big old belly. And pretty soon, even the baggy sweatshirts couldn't hide what was happening, right? This life is growing inside of her, and you get to a point where you cannot hide it. I'm not calling you sin, babe. That's not what I'm doing. You weren't. That's not what I'm trying to say there. Y'all understand what I'm saying. It's like the moment comes when sin is fully grown. And despite our best efforts, we cannot hide it anymore. We may think it's hidden because we've convinced ourselves that it is, but it's not. People see it. People notice it. We think we could control it because at one time maybe we could when it was small. But now it's grown. We can't control it anymore. It controls us. And it will bring death. That's a promise. It will bring death. And it doesn't care who or what it ruins in the process. Your family, your reputation, your career, your witness, your health, your happiness. It does not care. All of this happens to David. All of it. We talk a lot about his victories and the good things that he did, and we should, because he did a lot of good things, but he did a lot of bad things. He was well-balanced, I would say. And next week, we're going to see how all this wreckage from David's sin, it didn't stop with those innocent villagers. That had been enough, but it escalates. It grows. It continues to grow. I'm going to stop there. So I guess I just want to ask us all to kind of like honestly take some inventory of ourselves. Look at our lives. And if there's something in there, no matter how small, how inconsequential we may think it is, if it's something that we know God would not be happy about, let's pull it out. Let's go find a shovel. Let's get it out of there.